RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Now we're going to discuss the distinction between a university and a culturally based education institution, and whether it's time the government, our government, but this applies all around the world really, should be intervening against the cultural reshaping of our institutions. And joining us to talk about this is John Rain, an Emeritus Professor of Engineering, formerly holding positions as Pro Vice Chancellor Research and Innovation at AUT, Deputy Vice Chancellor at Albany and International Massey University, and Pro Vice Chancellor Enterprise and International at University of Canterbury. He's had a long-term involvement in New Zealand's innovation system and chaired the government's Powering Innovation Review in 2011. And John Rain is with us here on RCR, beaming in all the way from France. John, thanks for coming on. We appreciate it.
You're welcome, Paul. Good evening.
I'm going to start with the dumb guy in the street question, John, if you don't mind. How close to being stuffed are our universities?
Paul, look, I think in many respects they're not in bad shape. It's just that there are some things happening that have been ringing alarm bells, and you will know from your earlier conversations some of these concerns from Elizabeth Rata and people like James Kierstead or Paul Moon.
Yeah. Okay. Is there anything you need to put on the table, John? That's nicely answered, by the way, before we talk some more.
Paul, I come at this really as an observer at this stage. I formally retired close to 3 years ago, but I have a number of colleagues still in the system who have felt that they felt reluctant to speak on these issues for fear of being cancelled or that it might damage their career within the university. And I think it's really important that as a society we can discuss what sort of culture we're living in, what sort of culture we need to have in our universities so that they continue to meet the international idea of what a university should be.
Okay, got that. So does that mean that our culture as it's developing is kind of forgetting what universities are and are there for? Because I used to, I haven't spent any time at universities, but it was always known, kind of by everybody, why they were there, what they did, and the kind of attitude to knowledge and discovery. It was pretty well understood.
Yes, I think there's been a degree of change, but the universities they're still in pretty good shape. But there's been somewhat of a shift in the thinking in particular areas, particularly in departments such as in education and social sciences. And what I'd like to do is just draw the difference between the liberal epistemology or nature of knowledge and critical social justice, which is really where the nub of this lies. In the universities, we should be seeking for truth. All matters should be open for discussion, open inquiry. Things could be debated by students and staff. And it should be able to be done without fear of reprisal or silencing. And that the university itself should stand separate from that. So the university is the place in which this happens, but once the university starts to take a position that says, well, we expect you to behave in this particular way, other than being civilized and obeying the law, then we run the risk of an indoctrination environment. If you move across to critical social justice epistemology, which has grown a great deal in the last 50 years, this is what is really quite present across the Western world in universities now. And it's where it denies the existence of objective reality. You've got the alternative ways of knowing, that truth is merely claims to truth are merely claims to power, and that lived experience and subjectivism really trump objective knowledge that might say come from science. So you can see that difference means that you open the door to be able to bring in ideas that might be, for example, based on mysticism or myth or religion into science, and that causes an immediate problem. Now, this wouldn't matter too much because all of these things should be discussed and debated, but the moment you start to impose a particular way that you must think certain things are, you cannot deny them, they're there, you must accept them, then you are into that zone of indoctrination. And this has started to happen in some areas. And once you've got that, then the university fails to meet its true purpose.
Is that moving into areas that you are from? Engineering, for example. It's pretty straightforward. Carry on.
I think that it's been most prevalent in areas such as education, social sciences, to some extent in the humanities, but it has started to appear in the sciences. And you'll be aware of that mandatory Waipapa Taumata Row course, which is intended at the University of Auckland, which contains significant Treaty of Waitangi content. Because that cannot be debated and questioned by students or staff, but it's really presented as as something which isn't up for discussion, then that immediately is indoctrination content. In my area of engineering, I think there's been very little to date of this, but it has appeared in areas such as sustainability, where some ideas from Maori culture around the nature of the environment and spiritual and animist beliefs have been presented as part of that. I don't think there's a lot of room in an engineering course for these things. That it's a very tightly packed curriculum, and while it's important that we understand different societal views, I don't think that there's a great deal of room to be introducing a large amount of treaty content.
No, but it can be used as a way of taking power over that discipline, right, and controlling it, even if there's not much room for. Though I do remember there was an issue with the Taniwha and the Waikato Expressway a way back, because I remember reading that in the news when I used to read news at RNZ. But it was kind of a bit of a laugh thing. But you know, it's about power, isn't it? Having power over things in the end.
It is indeed. If you are coming from that, particularly from that critical social justice point of view, you are presenting an idea which cannot be falsified the way you might try and falsify something in science through experiment. You're presenting something which is actually an act of belief or faith as being, well, this is the way it is. I think there is an element of power involved in that. I mean, one example was the recent discussion in the piece by Gary Judd around the Northland Council and issues around water there, and the invoking of the spiritual nature of water, which was a Maori view. And of course, my view as a person of science is that it's a molecule of two atoms of hydrogen and one atom of oxygen. But
if power is exercised in that way, even engineers, not you necessarily, but people in that discipline, again, that the ability to be honest and to speak out and to have an opinion is heavily compromised, isn't it? That's really what that means.
I think it can be compromised if people feel that if they speak out, they could be called racist for disagreeing with an assertion that may come from Maori culture. And therefore, that implication that you must agree with this, otherwise you are not acceptable. I think that is an issue. Yeah.
Yeah. Are your former colleagues or people, still your colleagues, people you talk to, feeling that right now? Are they feeling that?
Look, right around the world, people who have spoken out in academia around the broader area around diversity, equity, inclusion, which is sits within that critical social justice framework, have been deplatformed, lost academic prospects, possibly lost jobs. Examples include, for example, Eric Kaufman, who moved from Birkbeck University in London to Buckingham University because he refused in the end to go along with the DEI policies of the institution. In at James Cook University in Queensland, Dr. Peter Ridd lost his job because he presented ideas publicly that went against the university's university view, here we are, around climate change, because his research showed that the damage to the Great Barrier Reef was not actually happening. Within New Zealand, as the report of Dr. James Kierstead from the New Zealand Initiative has shown, there have been numerous instances of staff feeling their academic freedom has been compromised. Now, that isn't simply to do with the treaty. There are all sorts of reasons why someone may have been asked to be silent. They may have criticized, for example, the university's financial policies. But yes, there have been numerous instances of New Zealand of staff feeling that they cannot speak out, and if they do, that their chances of advancement in the system are compromised, or worse still, they may be on a redundancy list. Now, it's important not to exaggerate this, but it is real.
Yeah. Elizabeth Rata, when we were speaking to her a few weeks ago, she mentioned indigenization and retribalization as it relates to this. And one of the interesting things she said a lot of interesting things. One thing that I remember was, and many from overseas were involved in this, kind of being part of this retribalization effort and sort of trying to find, I don't know what, something inside the university ecosystem that fundamentally, and it talks about what you're talking about here, alters, you know, the established culture for what, I don't know. They're on maybe some religious finding trip like many people are on altogether. But that seems to me to be an interesting one to think about and try and explain how a group can come together wanting, I don't know, something in their life which is not part of their culture. Many from no history in New Zealand coming here and kind of imposing it or being part of imposing it on our institutions, which are funded by taxpayers, generations of New Zealand taxpayers, nothing to do with them. What do you make of what she had to say about that? Is that a phenomenon?
Yes, it is. Ubiquitous throughout the universities, but there's one example that came to light just the last few days about the School of Clinical Science at AUT, which has a curriculum framework statement which is, it's really very solid treaty polemic, and it's decolonization polemic, I should say, because you know, when you read through the various statements within this, I won't go into the detail. There's very little about the academic nature of what goes on there, but it's about indigenization of that particular school, and what they're talking about really is a shifting of a culture away from what might be seen as the culture of the colonial power. So this is about, comes back to the power, claims to power issue, which I was talking about under the critical social justice epistemology, and that the power lay with the that colonial system, and that needs to be replaced because that is not allowing Maori to succeed in the system. Now, all of us who've been in that system for a very long time would dispute that because, you know, for years, many, and I was involved in this, worked hard to open the doors, bring more Maori into the system, both as students and ultimately as staff. And I think welcoming that cultural enrichment from seeing some Maori culture within the university, even the courses that you might want to teach, though they might sit better in anthropology or history, but some of them don't sit in science where they're trying to insert them. But if you then say, well, no, we don't just want to have a presence and to celebrate a different culture within the system, but that culture needs to become the pervasive culture within the university, and we want to effectively indigenize, decolonize, then you've shifted the nature of the organization, and it becomes something where the permitted way of thinking has been constrained. And that really raises a red flag around the international standing of the organization in the future, around its attractiveness to international students or even our local students. I have heard cases of parents who've said, well, we are going to send our son or daughter overseas to universities because we're concerned about the direction of New Zealand universities now. Now, it's important not to generalize from the particular, but these instances illustrate the effect of a decolonization agenda. And I agree with you that it is not really appropriate for the university to become monocultural, focused around a very small percentage of the population. It should be absolutely culturally neutral and welcoming of all of the 100 plus different ethnicities who would be attending as students, open to all of their cultural ideas and welcome discussion across the spectrum. And it's I think unhelpful to the cause of people who want to see greater success for Maori in our education system to say, well, the whole system needs to change, because I think that is a wrong objective.
So it's ultimately a failed experiment, really, if you want to sort of roll it forward and see where it ends. Better to get out now before it goes.
Well, that's an interesting question, Paul. Neil Ferguson, who's the very highly esteemed historian, who has just set up with colleagues the new University of Austin in Texas on the basis that it would be absolutely neutral in terms of any of these issues that might be seen as political, and it would even have a constitution to ensure that freedom of speech existed. It would not experience cultural capture by diversity, equity, and inclusion agendas. And he was saying that he thought it would take. This was in a speech he gave in March this year called After the Treason of the Intellectuals. And he gave it at an early meeting of that new university. And he was saying that he thought that the American system would take well beyond his lifetime, and he's in his early 60s, I think, to drop drop this sort of critical social justice ethos, which has captured a lot of academia. And he was talking about the very high percentage now of academics who were seen to be left-leaning in their politics, and that somehow has become strongly associated with this movement. So if you come back to New Zealand to try and answer your question, at this stage, it would be too early to call it a failed experiment, but my prediction would be that if we go down this pathway, then the future would see New Zealand universities as become rather narrowly focused, looking as though they had become defined by one particular culture, a bit the way, and if to take an example, the Islamic University in Malaysia is defined very much by Islam. If we say, well, New Zealand universities might be defined by Te Ao Māori, then the perception of outside observers would be there is an organization where certain ways of thinking are not permitted, or you're expected rather to at least follow and believe certain things. And that, in my view, will make our universities less attractive as international teaching and research partners, and certainly less attractive to international students. And therefore, I would predict that it would end up as a failed, we'd call it a failed experiment, but I don't think that it would be for the good of the universities in the long term. If for one reason would be that if you're not attracting students, financial viability becomes more challenging as well.
Yes, well, that's another thing. But also, don't you get a monoculture of graduates moving into the public sector, let's say, and I'm thinking about public service and other public institutions that do draw from universities, and you get this sort of this vortex effect of it sort of doubling down on itself more and more, and it pushes the country in a bigger picture in a not so, I would say anyway, desirable direction, and has big consequences more than just the university.
Oh, absolutely. I think that if you have students sitting in a learning culture where certain things are delivered as doctrine, if you like, and that might be, for example, a certain view of the meaning of the Treaty of Waitangi rather than a different view. And it might be a view that it was all about colonial oppression and destruction of a culture rather than other more positive aspects. If students come out saying, well, we've got to change the whole of society because of this, that could be a view that is slanted one way, whereas what we're looking for is to have students, if they're going to be studying treaty politics in the university, they would get to see all the different angles, as indeed one would hope would be happening with the discussion of David Seymour's bill right now, and that you're not subjecting students to one particular view, and that they would come out of university with a much wider and flexible and thoughtful and critical view of what has happened, what could happen in the future for New Zealand, and that we're not indoctrinating students for a particular purpose, because I think that is dangerous for our society. It's dangerous for democracy.
It's funded substantially, I believe, about between 70% and 80% of universities' funding is from a taxpayer, ultimately. And obviously there's opportunities, and maybe you've got a different thought on that ratio, but obviously there's opportunities to overseas students and all that. I think there are many New Zealanders now who are starting to question whether they want any of their taxes put towards any of this stuff anymore, certainly going forward. How do we think about, well, we've kind of, you've given us a sort of an insight into how things should look in the future, let's say. But how should a reset, if one is needed, be undertaken, John? It sounds like a huge job. It have to come from top down politically, I would imagine. Maybe there's a few murmurings. Maybe there's some direction being taken on that. But how do you unbundle the bundle that's developing, do you think?
That's a huge question, Paul, and I don't profess to have all the answers. If I did, the government might not have needed to have put Sir Peter Gluckman's University Advisory Group together.
Yep. No point taken. But
I think I would say we've got to look at three things. First of all, is the culture of the organisation, which is what we've been discussing. The absolutely vital importance of having an environment of open inquiry, where students and staff can fearlessly discuss subjects without being concerned about whether they might be cancelled. And it's interesting that overseas, and one figure Neil Ferguson mentioned, was that somewhere around 50% of students in the United States were concerned about speaking out in class in case they might be cancelled. And there were a number of stats he presented in that talk, and it's well worth listening to. So that the culture is vitally important, and that includes protection of academic freedom. And I'm confident that Sir Peter Gluckman's group will be speaking on that one, because it lies at the heart of ensuring that universities are places of open inquiry and discussion. And if you move on from culture, you've got the issue of academic programs and then the sort of financial and administrative strategy of the organization. Universities now, to some degree, compete with other online educators. And since around 1990, when the universities were put on a market-led model, we've seen this commoditization of university education, where it was pretty much open to anyone who could come up with the student fee or the part that the student had to pay. And the barriers to entry, the bar has been set pretty much lower and lower. It used to be pretty much a meritocracy to get in. You needed to get pretty good grades at school. And what happened in New Zealand also, it really reflected what was going on in the Northern Hemisphere and in Britain, where they looked to remove that social hierarchy of access. And that led to the British universities now then being accompanied by former polytechnics as new universities. And to some degree, this happened in New Zealand with AUT becoming a university. But that democratization has had some adverse effects, so that the we've had competition for student clients, I'm going to call them clients, and that has also led to a proliferation of numbers of courses that the taxpayer might raise an eyebrow about funding. But the question is, where should that focus lie in the future? Do we move back to more of a meritocratic system, where you say, well, yes, we want the universities partly because they have both a teaching and a research function. So you can't just say, well, let's get rid of the universities, because they carry out a very significant proportion of the country's research activity. But you could say, well, let's let certain programs go back to the polytechnic or online providers. And you know, I'd get beaten up by some colleagues if I was to suggest too many different courses where that might occur. But certain programs would certainly stay within the university. The professional ones, like areas of the law, engineering, medicine, and so on. But for a university to be a university, it needs that diversity of courses, and the humanities and sciences need to be quite widely represented. And I think I come back to the distinction that because university teaching should be research-led, you are looking at teaching students to think critically and to evaluate information, to seek for objective truth. And in that regard, it is quite difficult to say, well, what are you going to eliminate? And it could be that competition might say, well, in areas of IT or accounting or business, online courses that provide an acceptable qualification for a lot of employers, and they might be quicker, and a student can do them at home. Sure, the quality might not be there, but it might be sufficient for a particular employer. So I would not be surprised if in the future the percentage of students out of the total population, the percentage attending university, might fall a bit from where it is right now. That as the country's population grows, then the absolute number may go on increasing. But right now, the universities are carrying a lot of capital infrastructure, and they obviously want the students to fill the places that are available. But there could be some pain in the short-term future because, international enrollments are still trying to recover after the COVID years. And we do have this issue about what programs should be taught in the future. Will we see some programs being shared between universities for purposes of cost efficiency, so you don't get staff trying to teach the same small course in several different universities? So I think there will be some creative thinking going on about system efficiency, and the important thing with these academic programs is that they are of a high standard, and that we achieve an appropriate balance between utilitarianism, which might be the courses that are needed for the professions, and the wider purpose of a university, which is general curiosity-driven education, which is important for our society to sustain. I haven't answered your question clearly there, Paul. It is
No, I think you kind of have. One of the things that stood out earlier that you said, you described students as clients, right? Because they're paying to be there. Now, I know about clients. I've been in advertising, and you keep the client happy. And you're talking about the bar being lowered. Do you get, in effect, treating paid clients as clients in this sort of system, university system? You get the tail wagging the dog effect, don't you? Because clients have a lot of power while they're paying, and you're depending on their paying. You're going to keep them happy. And you get...
Oh, yeah.
Is that something that happens? We get the tail starting to wag the dog. Now you're pleasing... and young people are idealistic, and they'll find out one day. But in that stage of life, their needs and wants could be unrealistic in terms of what a university has to deliver.
Look, I think you're absolutely right there. Back in the day, we were told to sort of kind of be quiet, listen, soak it up, and do the job. And we had very little, if you like, client power. Students these days, and one byproduct of the commoditization was that the administrations within the universities have grown massively. So we have these very large student services departments now for student learning support, student pastoral care, diversity, equity, and inclusion support teams, and of course the Māori and Pasifika support teams, and so on. And of course, as a consequence, financial services and HR have grown massively. And New Zealand's ended up with one of the highest ratios of non-academic staff to academic staff in the world at about 1.5 to 1, and that needs sorting. But coming back to the student question, yes, the students will tend to be far more critical and look for service delivery, if you like. Of course, the staff are somewhat hostage to student evaluations as well, because they are assessed on those. And there is some kind of, there's a little bit of pressure beneath there for staff to get students through the system. And Of course, the TEC, I don't believe, really helped this by introducing the recovery of funds paid to the universities if course pass rates were not high enough. Because you see, once you start incentivizing universities to get students through in order to get their money from the government, you run the risk of grade inflation. And I think to some degree that occurred. So the universities, I believe, have to start holding the line again on merit and excellence. I think that's absolutely fundamental. And that we should be moving away from diversity, equity, and inclusion criteria, driving things like staff appointments. We need to be very careful about things like affirmative action with student admissions, and that we ensure that excellence in achievement is a really key focus. I guess, you know, you did ask what the other factors were. I mean, we haven't really discussed the one around the financial model. And I don't know that I should go too far into that. I have mentioned the administrative overhead that these organizations carry these days. And I do think that it would be a good idea if Sir Peter Gluckman's group addressed that and looked at ways where the government could incentivize the universities to reduce their administrative or their non-academic to academic staff ratio back to about 1-to-1. A lot of good American universities, it's only 0.8-to-1. There's, I think, quite a lot of mileage there. Essentially, the universities are autonomous. So, the government, if it intervenes, it has to be through the Education and Training Act. They could revise that to lighten the duties in regard to the treaty. The statements there are pretty minimal at the moment, merely that university councils should acknowledge the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi. But they could also, apart from ensuring freedom of speech, they could actually have some influence over funding, like saying, well, you know, we're not going to fund courses which are indoctrination courses. But the actual administering of that would be quite challenging.
Yeah. They could just come out and say, number one, you're all on notice now. We don't like this. It's not feeling good. I know it's amorphous and it's not very detailed, but you fire the first shot. And, of course, you have to have political capital to spend there. And I'm thinking, just from what I see with our, okay, we have a particular audience, but the people that we've spoken to, is that there is a growing awareness and unease about where this is going now. So maybe it's the right time to make some kind of political move, albeit slightly soft at first, but just to show that this, you know, this kind of can't go on like this for much longer, you know.
Well, I agree. I need to be careful not to be too dogmatic in things I'm saying because I'm not working in the system.
No, fair enough. Yeah.
But I'm talking to about 60 or 80 people on a regular basis who are. And I think that there is sufficient concern about the direction that Sir Peter Gluckman's group really do need to work with government to provide some different signals and to achieve some change. I think that what could be interesting would be if one university had a council and vice chancellor that said, well, look, we're going to break ranks. We're not going to be Te Tiriti led. We respect the treaty. We're going to do our utmost to encourage a Maori student presence and even Maori culture within our organisation, but it will not be the defining culture. And we will avoid being captured by critical social justice agendas in the same way that Sir Neil Ferguson is doing with the University of Austin. It'd be very interesting to see if that were done, how that university might fare with being attractive to staff and students. And, you know, I look at one or two of the others that are heading very strongly in a different direction, such as Massey. And, you know, one is concerned for how they will go with enrolments in the future. And I think that the government ought to do what it can to try and steady the ship, because things are not entirely comfortable right now, that's for sure.
It'll be interesting to see if someone did break ranks, what would happen there. I got a feeling what would happen. Instant
what
market
do you think
share.
Would happen?
I think market share would suddenly spike through the roof. That's what I think. But what do I know? You know, what do I know?
Well, I do agree with you on that.
Maybe that's how it has to happen. I think you're right. That's probably the way. But then that takes the courage to do it, you know.
I think one other thing is that the government needs to continue its role in auditing excellence in research that was done through the Performance-Based Research Fund in the past. And I think also in teaching, and that process, without being something that is seen to be dictatorial from government, because that would be inappropriate, could help ensure that that courses remain absolutely politically neutral, and that they are simply aimed at open discourse and excellence and objective seeking of the truth.
Wow, what a really interesting chat, John Rain. Thank you for coming on and making some time for us all the way from the other side of the planet.
You're most welcome, Paul. I quite often think that it's probably time to shut up and let the next generation carry the baton on this one. But it is interesting, and I think that it's important that we try to keep an open mind and discuss these things. I think if things are sort of said, no, this is the way we've got to go, you cannot discuss it, then we're in trouble. Provided our academic communities remain open to discussion within themselves, that they don't get captured by one line of thinking, then they'll remain in good health. And that is vital to the future of the system.
Yeah. Thank you, John Rain, for coming on RCR. We appreciate it.
You're welcome, Paul.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.